my general theme is how we got where we are, which was asked me to speak. But that involves knowing where we are, so we know how we got where we are. It also involves a preliminary discussion of what history is all about. What is history? What does history mean? Now, I gave a lot last year on this. I'm not going to do that this year, except to review briefly one or two ideas and point out that man has to interpret history somehow. Man is bound by his very nature as a creature, and even in his fallen nature, as a prophet, priest, and king, he must come to some conclusion as to whether his existence makes sense, whether his present existence makes sense, whether his past is understandable. And down through the ages, since the days of Herodotus and other early writers, mankind has constantly grappled, one way or another, with the meaning of history. Herodotus and the Greeks, of course, believing in a closed universe, also held to a closed view of history, which we call the cyclical view of history. And Herodotus very plainly said in his writings, of what will be, to quote the famous modern song. He said this, that history is subject to fate, it is cyclical in nature, it repeats itself, and thus it has no basic meaning or purpose. So history as a study got off on the wrong foot with the Greeks, with the assumption and the assertion, the insistence, that history is irrational and therefore without meaning, which is, of course, characteristic of the whole idea of the meaning of history for them. Irrationalism, philosophy, bred irrationalism in history. And in spite of his glorious writings, as many people looked upon them, of the Persian Wars, about which he did write, for the Greek historian, whether it be Thucydides or Herodotus, or the Roman historians, whether it was Stoic or Epicurean, most of them were Stoics. Basically, in spite of the superficial idea that history has meaning in terms of the glorification of Rome or of the freedom of Athens as over against the tyranny of the Persians, history basically had to be irrational and without purpose and without meaning, because they reduced history to natural law concepts as their foundation. Now, thus we see that in the interpretation of history, we've always had to do one thing. We have either looked at history from the point of view of philosophy, some particular form of philosophy, or we have looked at history from the point of view of theology. It's either to be interpreted philosophically, or it is to be interpreted theologically. This is the history of historical interpretation. And since all philosophy is basically a product of man's fallen mind, thus all attempts to interpret history philosophically must ultimately fail at one point or another, and in general at most points. They've all fallen short, far short, of any consistent interpretation of historical data. But look at the problem. And so we're forced to look at the problem of the meaning of history. An historian who gets his facts has done half of his job, if he ever gets half of his facts, or if he ever gets his facts. The other half of the job, and the much more difficult job, is to interpret what you get. People think of ancient history and say, well, it's so hard to get the facts. Believe me, it's not. It's not hard to get the facts of ancient history. The documents are there. The Greek and the Roman and the other documents are available. I don't mean to say the original sources, but I mean our knowledge of them. We have it. But the problem, even with ancient history, is to interpret it. There's as much disagreement over the meaning of ancient history as there is over more recent modern European or American history. Tremendous amount of disagreement over the meaning of ancient history. And so, in today's lecture, I would simply try to bring to you the span of history and how we must approach history. Every Christian, as well as every unbeliever, is called upon to understand his own existence, to understand his own meaning and purpose in life, and to, therefore, to understand the meaning of history. I've heard good evangelical ministers say that they're not really much interested in the past, they're only interested in the future. Well, I would want them to be interested in the future. I would never deny that. But an interest in the future, which is not predicated upon God's overruling sovereignty in regard to the past, is a truncated view of the future. And much, I would say this, much of the so-called teaching of prophecy today has been grounded and brought to a halt and has had disastrous results because it has not been rooted and grounded in the biblical view of history. If you're going to understand the future, we first must understand the past. And to understand the past, we must, to the extent to which God has revealed it to us, we must understand the past in terms of how God interprets the past. For basically, God has given his meaning to history. I have this summer forced three students doing three independent studies using the phrase in Galatians, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son. And I'm having them do a study in the relationship between the history of Israel and the history of Rome and Babylon, Syria and Persia, and Egypt, in the light of that phrase which Paul has in Galatians. How then does ancient history relate to the history of Israel, the covenant people? And how does the history of Israel relate to the history of what we call the secular kingdoms of the pre-Christian era? This is a tremendous study, and it brings to light so much of Old Testament history, as we see the children of Israel having their setting in that ancient world, and it brings whole new meaning to what Paul has said concerning the incarnation in Galatians. When the fullness of time had come, what does that mean? Well, I'm not here to discuss that with you today particularly, except to point out that it is a crucial statement for the understanding of history, not only in regard to the fact that God has set his meaning to the fullness of time, but also how God used all of history to that time to bring about the fullness of time. So that we're forced then to consider history from the point of view of biblical or Christian theology. Now, of course, I should admit that today there is a school of thought which holds that history has no meaning. This is the existential school. And they've had considerable sway. They've made considerable headway. The history is meaningless. You see why they say this. Because if human life is without meaning, if your life and if my life is without meaning, without purpose, then obviously the collective life, the collective history of all of humanity must be equally meaningless in their thinking. And so it becomes a problem for them why they ever bother to study history. If it is without meaning, if it is without purpose, why teach it? Unless it simply means of making money from some school or college. Thus, history has a tremendous span, and the Christian therefore must be concerned with military activity, with all other types of activity, economic, social, sociological, intellectual. He must be concerned with all aspects of human life over the long span of history. True enough, we have courses in ancient history. And that's due to the fact that we can only get through so much history in any given period. We have courses in American history. We have courses in modern European history. And in that sense, we sometimes truncate history and we're arbitrary in the way we divide it up. And this is unfortunate, but it can't be helped, the academic year being what it is. And sometimes gives students a wrong idea, as if the modern world suddenly came into existence in 1485 in England or in France or in Germany. But it didn't. Or as if the ancient world suddenly ended, in one sense, with the coming of Christ, the fall of the Roman Empire. It didn't at all. History is a seamless web. And, of course, this gives us a grandeur, this gives us a glory, and, of course, this gives to us a challenge to examine. So very briefly, as we come to the idea of where we are and why we are where we are, let us look briefly then, and I mean briefly, at the biblical view of history. And for that, I shall use St. Augustine's De Civitate Dei in the English, the City of God. What then does history really mean? And I would bring to your attention that the meaning of history is deeply rooted and inseparable from the doctrine of creation. Now, you'll get your doctrinal studies elsewhere. And I don't believe that Dr. Smith will deal with doctrine of creation as such this time, as we did last year with Dr. Lee and him. But I would say this, that history has a beginning. It's not, as the Greeks thought, an endless series of events, cyclical in nature. It's not the Hegelian doctrine of history, of the endless dialectic. It's not the Marxian doctrine of an endless dialectical materialism. It's not any philosophical concept. History has a beginning. Only theology, only Christian theology, gives to history the idea of a beginning. And that beginning is given to history by a sovereign God. Thus only, and I say this advisedly, only Reformed theology can possibly explain the origin and meaning of history. Now, I do not mean to imply that other theological systems have not spoken on this wise. I do not mean this. But I do mean, as Dr. Smith said this morning in his first lecture, in regard to the kingship of Jesus Christ, that neither Lutheranism, nor Protestant Arminianism, nor Thomism within the Roman Church have been able to really speak to the meaning of history, because they have not paid adequate attention, in my opinion, to the kingship of Jesus Christ and to the sovereignty of God the Father in human affairs by properly locating history in the act of creation. This begins history. This begins history. Historians love to say, no documents, no history. And with that I agree. Because for God's history, we have the earliest possible documents, the Holy Scriptures, which give to us the basic clue to the meaning of all human existence in the ancient world. The doctrine of creation by a sovereign personal God gives history its beginning. If I were to continue along these lines, I would point out another very important factor, that this doctrine of creation, as we find it in the Scriptures, and so tremendously elaborated by Augustine, also gives to us the real meaning of human personality. Because history is the history of personalities. It's the history of men created in the divine image. You realize, of course, that Greek history never had a doctrine of personality. Greek philosophy never had a doctrine of human personality. It never evolved one. It never achieved one for one very good reason. Philosophy can never answer the question of who and what is man. Philosophy can never answer that question. It has never answered that question. And today it is in retreat, having realized its failure. It has less to say today about that than ever. But in the doctrine of the Trinity, as that doctrine was quarried from the great granite quarries of Scripture, by the Council of Nicaea, 325, by Athanasius particularly, and by Augustine, and of course, by the men at Chalcedon. This doctrine of the Trinity is a true biblical doctrine, but it speaks the whole problem of history, because in the light of doctrine of Trinity, we see man as prophet, priest, and king. We see man created in the image of God. We see man bearing God's imprint of purpose. We see man bearing God's imprint of meaning. Thus, history assumes meaning when man assumes meaning in the light of God's revelation as to what we are by the fact of creation. Man was created in the image of God, and you'll hear a great deal in these lectures about man bearing the divine imprint, man in the image of God, to do God's will economically, to do God's will ethically, to do God's will in every aspect of life. Thus, history reveals God's will for man in what we might call common or general revelation. It has received its purpose in God and through God. It has received its meaning from God and through God. And only in this biblical frame of reference does history come alive. It's no wonder that modern man, modern historical scholars, have finally given up trying to find meaning in history. You can see this very clearly in modern textbooks. If you've looked at college textbooks, you will see the decline of the whole attempt to find meaning. I think it was Prentice Hall, perhaps I shouldn't mention the name, but one of those publishers sent to me a couple of months ago a textbook called Hang-Ups from a Way Back. The title thrilled me. It was so academic and intellectual. And I threw it away. Finally, the man came after him and said, why didn't you like that copy I sent you? I said, well, I didn't like the title. I did look through it. And I said, I threw it away. He said, you're not going to use it. I said, no. I said, we're college. And I said, we're sophisticated in our approach to history. And he didn't have much to say at that point. But for years, I used Morrison Combinger's the Oxford American History, the two volumes, Growth of the American Republic. Well, I stopped using it because as Mr. Morrison retired and Henry Combinger took over, there was less and less history in the volumes and less meaning as Mr. Combinger became more involved with revolutionary activity and less involved in historical scholarship. And Morrison, of course, was no longer editing. He was no longer doing his part. Volume 1 continued to have his work, but Volume 2 became slimmer and slimmer and slimier and slimier. And so I stopped using it. And finding college textbooks is very difficult. Not too long ago, the wife of one of my students sent to me a copy of a textbook used in North Carolina. I forget the name of the thing, but I read the textbook because it was a jewel. The textbook started off with this idea. The purpose of this textbook is not to teach. That was very evident. But then the next sentence, and the girl who underlined this for my attention, ran like this. The purpose of this textbook is to get students to ask questions. But you see, there was nothing in the textbook which would even evoke the faintest kind of a question, except possibly why it was printed. That was the only question. That's the only question I could get out of it. For very obvious reasons, if you have seen the textbook. You see, historians have given up on the idea of any motivating power in history. History is an aimless conglomeration of facts which are no longer worth remembering. Therefore, you don't really write textbooks to have students remember things. You write students to engineer questions. But about what? I don't see anybody can get a question out of the textbook. There was nothing in it. It wasn't worth publishing. And when the man from that company had happened to come about college textbooks, I told him that. He said recently, an irate professor from another college, he didn't name the college, called up the main office and said, he said, do you have a really good history textbook for college students on the 8th grade level? It might have been somebody from here, I don't know. He wouldn't tell me the name, but I was sort of curious. Now, Augustine and the scriptures point out that history receives its meaning because it has an author. Who gave it meaning? Who gave it purpose? And who gave it destiny? And Augustine points out, continues to point out, and he makes a great deal of use of this idea of the fullness of time. in the fullness of time, the great central point of history is the coming, that is the birth of Jesus Christ. This is the focal point to which all of ancient history looks forward. This is how ancient history should be taught, incidentally, that Persia, Babylon, Syria, Egypt, Alexander the Great, Athens, all these ancient kingdoms, perhaps in a way we don't always see, but they all prepare the way for the coming of Jesus Christ. And here's little old Israel, tucked away down there in the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea, surrounded by tremendous neighbors, powerful, culturally elite, yet they all disappeared. And yet, Rome took over Palestine, and in a very real sense, propelled Palestine and Israel to a new place of great importance, because they were under protection of the Roman Empire, as we heard so well last night. And Augustine saw this very, very clearly, but he saw something else, which is closely related to this, that not only is the incarnation the center of history, but that the central institution of history is the elect of God. The elect of the Old Testament, the elect of the New Testament. That all history, whether it be ancient history or the history in the Christian era, refers to the elect of God, that is, the true church. This is a tremendously important point, which many, many modern evangelicals have either misused or totally forgotten. That the events of his day, the fall of Rome in 410, if you use that date, or 378, it makes no difference, but the process, the fall of Rome, had reference to the church. That the church had begun to develop, not in the days of the decline, but in the days when Rome was first emerging in its imperial greatness, giving a mantle of protection to the church it hated, giving a mantle of the possibility of preaching the gospel to the known civilized world, which it would never have before, and would never have again. Rome served its purpose, and it served the purpose for the church, the elect of God, throughout the ages. And we need to recover this idea. Modern history is filled with millions of events that are beyond us, but events that seem to have no particular significance suddenly come to life with tremendous significance. As we look back, we're beginning to see what the rise of Hitler, for instance, had to do with the church, or the rise of Mussolini, or other events like that, World War II, for instance. And the days ahead, this will become clearer and clearer if we interpret these events in the light of God's Word. But historians who do not do this today are utterly overwhelmed, not only by the mass of data which confronts them, but also by the meaning, or lack of meaning, of that data, till they give up in sheer despair. Now you see, Augustine, having insisted that history has its ground of meaning and purpose in divine sovereignty, and finds the evidence of that in the incarnation and in the ongoing of the church, thus could say, and he did say, that all history must be referred to the glory of God. Omnia ad gloriam Dei referenda est. All things must be referred to the glory of God. And then they utter that other great phrase, that gratia et electio sunt essentia et mysterium historiae, translating that grace and election are the essence and mystery of history. Grace and election are the essence and mystery of history. Grace, common and redeeming, and election are the essence and the meaning of history. If we can get this one idea, that grace and election are the essence and meaning of history, we will come a tremendous way toward the understanding, at least faintly, of all data. We can look on World War II We can look on the present state of this nation, or any other nation for that matter, in the light of this great truth. As he entered the city of God, he could see that for his day. And we must see it for our day. Now, this is the background of the span of history. History is the whole history of the human race. Some historians have said that it is all that man ever thought and said or did. Theoretically, this might be true. But, of course, this is beyond capture. We cannot recapture that. We have to deal with the documents. We must deal with economic facts. We must deal with political facts, with military facts, with social facts. We must deal with the life of the human mind. But we can only deal with all these facets of history in the light of the biblical revelation. Otherwise, it will become a meaningless jumble, of facts that just don't have any pattern, that don't fit together, have no meaning. And thus the historian surrenders in sheer despair to any philosophy that happens to attract him Christ-like. And history teaching for him simply becomes something to do in order to earn a living. And that's about it. Now, this is where we are. What time am I supposed to stop?
Up to another 15-20 minutes, if you wish. Well,
I've tried to bring us to a place to see what history is all about. History does have meaning. Now, modern history, of course, has been interpreted by many philosophies. And I should give you a note here to show you how modern man, from the Renaissance particularly, has deserted and departed from the biblical view of history. For although the Middle Ages, in the hands of St. Thomas Aquinas, departed seriously from Augustine's basic doctrine, curiously enough, it did not depart as much from his view of history. This whole Augustine idea of history never left the medieval mind. And in a man like Bishop Otto of Freising, it comes to life in his History of the Two Cities. This whole idea of the centrality of the Incarnation and of the centrality of the Church as an ongoing institution never was forgotten by the medieval mind. And when you have Anselm of Canterbury, this whole idea of the centrality of the Incarnation and of the centrality of the Church as an ongoing institution never was forgotten by the medieval mind. And when you have Anselm of Canterbury, you have it vividly brought out again in his great works on election, salvation, and so on, where he speaks again the mind of Augustine. You have it in some of the English scholars of the Middle Ages. You have it cropping up again in Bernard of Clairvaux and other scholars. It never died out throughout the entire medieval period. So we come to the Renaissance and the Reformation. And by our teaching history, I would point out that this is the beginning of our dilemma. I very, very seldom agree with Reinhold Niebuhr. I would make it a point not to. But in the February 22nd, 1947 issue of the Nation magazine, he wrote a lead article for a series, I think it was 10 articles, under the general title, Faith That Men Live By. And he wrote the lead article in which he said this in the opening paragraph, that the Renaissance is dead, thank God, and he was delighted to preach the funeral sermon. However, it wasn't as dead as he thought it was. He wrote, of course, in the light of the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he was hoping it was dead. And he had been delighted it had died. But he didn't realize that he was part of it. Of the very movement which was supposed to die. But nevertheless, he spoke the truth in that he realized that the events coming from World War II and the World War II itself were symptoms of death. Symptoms of the death of a culture. Symptoms of the death of Western civilization. And he was right about this, but how did we get to this place? I'm speaking now of the West, not of this country particularly. You see, the Reformation and the Renaissance were totally separate movements. Many people don't think about this, that they have almost nothing in common except that, in a sense, they were both born in the Middle Ages. To that extent, they had a common parentage. But the Renaissance denies practically everything that was good in the Middle Ages. While the Reformation was an attempt to repudiate the synthetic concepts of the Middle Ages, notably Aristotle in medieval thinking. In other words, the Reformers at no time denied that there was good in the Middle Ages. Calvin himself was tremendously influenced by men like Anselm of Bernard Clavel, and Franco admitted this. Luther himself was influenced by German mystics, by the Brethren of Common Life, and other late medieval divines. But they wanted to maintain the best of the Middle Ages and repudiate that which was not biblical, whereas the Renaissance wanted to repudiate the biblical and maintain the classical. And so, from the point of view of the interpretation of modern history, we can say that the Renaissance on the one hand and the Reformation on the other set up cultures which were diametrically in opposite to each other. They were in conflict. The Renaissance brought back again into the West the whole idea of man the maker of all things, which is a Greek idea. Whereas the Reformation, in a more powerful and pure form, revived with tremendous power the idea of Augustine that God himself must be the measure of all things. Not only history, economic activity. And so these two cultures are in deadly conflict. And thus the history of the West from that time on is the history of these two cultures in conflict. You start to think about that, you will see that it is true. And very shortly, I would say, beginning with Descartes, Leibniz, modern thought endeavored to frame a new philosophy which would interpret history, not in terms of Augustine, not in terms of the Reformation, but in terms of classical thought, with additions and knowledge thrown in, of course. And so with Descartes, Leibniz, and to a degree Spinoza, you have the modern humanistic attempt to interpret history again in the light of philosophy and to repudiate any sound biblical or theological approach to history. Now, I don't mean that these men were pagan. They were not. Descartes dutifully went to Mass once a week and then wrote philosophy directly contrary to the Christian faith the other 6 days. He was a Roman Catholic, Jesuit trained. Leibniz, in the Lutheran and Reformed tradition, did exactly the same thing. He went to church on the Lord's Day and then wrote a philosophy which was equally hostile to the Christian faith of the 6 days of the week. These men set up dichotomies in their own thinking. Spinoza, of course, was Jew. And he set up the same thing against traditional Judaism. And so modern philosophy sets out on a course which it calls independence. It will no longer use the scriptures as a frame of reference. And thus, modern philosophy seeks to interpret the historical past in terms of its own basic metaphysical or epistemological presuppositions. And when rationalism runs its course, we then have, of course, Locke come in with his empirical attempt to interpret all human data. It runs its course by the time of David Hume, and Kant comes in to correct the errors of the past, and with it to give a new interpretation of history based upon his own metaphysics. Hegel sees the errors in Kant. He corrects them by adding to the confusion. Some people think that Kant is hard to understand. I wouldn't say he isn't. But in my way of thinking, he's relatively easy compared to Hegel. Some people don't agree with that. And, of course, out of Hegel, we have any number of isms being spawned. Existentialism, Marxianism, and all the modern isms come from Hegel and from Kant, one way or another. And each one of them, in its own way, has sought to interpret human history. Hegel, Kant, Marx, and their modern offspring. Until the existentialist comes, and he surrenders, and says, it's no use. History has no meaning. It's shadow boxing on the wall of nothing. And so, he goes off into his corner and writes esoteric ideas, which have very little value, and textbooks which have less. Because you don't really teach history. You can't teach facts that have no meaning. And they're consistent. Very consistent. You cannot teach facts that have no meaning. And you can't expect students to remember facts that have no importance. They don't remember those that do. So how can you expect them to remember those that don't? It's impossible. Because they have no motivating force, no drive, nothing with which they can relate. So this is my introductory lecture on the span of history, so that we must, as I try to show in succeeding lectures, we must come back to the biblical world and life view, the biblical Weltanschauung, in regard to the meaning of history, if we're going to understand how we got where we are, because my next point would be, where are we? Where is this nation today? Where is the West today? I don't agree with Toynbee on many points. I very brashly told Mr. Toynbee that when I was with him. That didn't bother him because I found that he didn't agree with himself. And he was very nice. He was very nice. He admitted it. We can't go along with modern interpretations of history, whether they be existentialist, the orthodox, however seemingly attractive they may be. We cannot go along with the democratic view of history. We must base our concepts squarely and solely on the biblical revelation of what history is all about. And if we're to understand really the problems of Western culture today, we must begin with these biblical assumptions.